Welcome, everyone. You're tuning in to the Beyond the Pulse podcast, brought to you by the expert doctors at My Cardiologist, where we discuss a wide range of topics related to cardiovascular wellness and provide you with the knowledge, motivation, tips, and tools to help you make informed choices about your heart health. My Cardiologist is proud to be a leading provider of comprehensive cardiovascular care, serving the South Florida community for over 60 years. And we're thrilled to extend our care beyond the clinic through this podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Greenblatt. I'm a preventative and non-invasive cardiologist with My Cardiologist in Miami Beach and Aventura, and I'm happy to be here.
We're going to talk about a topic that I think that many people are very interested in, and that's diet, right? So how can we make dietary choices that promote heart health?
Yeah, that's a great question, because especially down here in Miami, I noticed that people are very into their diets. I moved down here from the Northeast, where people are less focused so much on their diets. Very active, a lot of mountains up there, a lot of biking, hiking, hunting. But down here in Miami, people seem to be very focused on their diets, and they have the opportunity to eat healthy, and they have a lot of options to do so. So the first thing that I want to touch on are heart-healthy foods. People want to avoid high fat, partially hydrogenated oils, trans fats, and saturated fats in general. Healthy foods include low fat yogurt, nuts such as walnuts, fish such as salmon, tuna, sardines that are high in omega-3 fish oil, avocados, olive oil, dark leafy vegetables. People should avoid the so-called white starches such as white bread, white rice, white potatoes.
Everything that's good.
Everything that tastes good. Yeah, exactly. So unfortunately, healthy carbohydrate alternatives are sweet potatoes, quinoa, brown rice. Okay. You're definitely going to get good overall health consuming those foods as opposed to the other ones that I mentioned. The other thing is, you know, people like to fry with butter, but people should move over to canola oil, and more specifically, olive oil is the healthier option there. With regard to red meat should be consumed probably at most once a week. And if you're going to have a steak, I would recommend that it be lean meat, like a filet or something, as opposed to a ribeye, which is going to be a more fatty.
More Mediterranean style diet.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Less fried, more grilled and baked.
Right. Okay. And what is your opinion on caffeine? Because I know everybody drinks coffee. I drink coffee. And what are some of the effects of caffeine on heart health?
Yeah, very good question. I, for one, was one of those physicians that didn't really believe that there was a correlation between caffeine and elevated blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And often I would have a patient who would come in for an 8 a.m. or 8:30 a.m. Visit. Blood pressure would be slightly elevated. And the patient would say to me, I just had a cup of coffee, so that probably explains why my blood pressure's up. And I would just kind of wave it off and say, I really don't think, you know, unless you slurp down your espresso or you had, you know, a venti-sized, what do they call it, cold brew coffee, I don't think it would have that much of an effect. But I did some research because, you know, I kept on hearing this and I was like, is there some truth to this statement? And it turns out actually that in some individuals, there's a sensitivity to caffeine and there is a contribution to elevated blood pressure. So in general, caffeine will transiently elevate the blood pressure short term. And for the amount of coffee that most people consume, it's not really an issue. The problem, however, is people with high blood pressure that are taking medication for high blood pressure should probably avoid drinking more than 200 milligrams of coffee per day. And so how do you calculate what 200 milligrams of coffee is? Right. So typically a standard cup of coffee, you know, not your venti Starbucks size coffee, a standard cup of coffee that you get in a 7-Eleven or, you know, the normal size Dunkin' cup, because I want to give equal advertising to all the companies out there. Standard cup of coffee is going to be about 95 to 100 milligrams. So two cups of coffee, after two cups of coffee, you've already consumed 200 milligrams of coffee. And I also want to point out that some of the energy drinks also have caffeine in them. So if you're one of those people taking blood pressure medication, you should, you know, don't pass the bar of 200 milligrams a day of caffeine.
Okay. And when should you take your blood pressure if you are drinking coffee?
Good question. So if you have an appointment with your primary care physician or your cardiology specialist, don't have a cup of coffee before your visit. Maybe save it until after the visit. The most significant complaint about ordering nuclear imaging stress testing on patients, and so what's a nuclear imaging stress test? It's a test where we give an isotope, inject it into the body, and we can see what the blood flow is within the heart. In some people who can't exercise on a treadmill, they need to be given a medication called Lexiscan. And the requirement for Lexiscan is that the patient not consume caffeine within 12 hours of the administration of this medication. So the biggest complaint I used to get from patients is, I cannot take this test because I cannot go more than 12 hours without having a cup of coffee.
The
lesson learned from this podcast is, don't drink coffee before your doctor's appointment because your blood pressure may be elevated transiently. And number two is, don't let caffeine intake block you from having an appropriate stress test that's ordered for you.
Okay. I know this is going to be a very loaded question, but for our listeners, what are the most effective lifestyle changes that can significantly reduce heart disease? And I want to get into, you know, we've talked about before, but we can mention it again, the lifestyle changes of, you know, smoking, alcohol consumption. And I also want to get into, which we can do it in parts, exercising. And we've had an off the mic conversation about breathing techniques that I really want to talk about.
Okay.
So, you know, we can start and just go into it.
Sure. So on the exercise topic, you know, the best thing to do is to consult with an exercise specialist or a trainer who could give an outline for an exercise regimen. And then after a few sessions with that individual, if a person has the discipline to kind of do that on their own, they could pursue that. The goal is 150 minutes divided 4 to 5 days a week. That's for moderate intensity. For strenuous intensity exercise, 75 minutes would suffice. If someone's interested in losing weight, then they would need to exercise more with a target of about 200 to 300 minutes a week of exercise. The reason I mentioned the trainer is because there are some exercises that could be injurious to an individual. And I think someone who knows what they're doing with regard to weights and so forth would be helpful and useful. The other thing is we don't want to exercise too much. So how much is too much exercise?
Right. Mm-hmm.
There are conditions. I mean, I'm not an exercise physiologist, but there are some conditions in which someone pushes the limit and that actually ends up with an untoward effect on the heart.
Okay. So what's the difference between moderate exercise and strenuous exercise? Can you give examples?
Right. So again, this is an exercise schedule should be outlined by an exercise specialist, such as a trainer. I think that moderate exercise would be, you know, running on a treadmill with a slight incline, or exercising on a bike with a certain degree of resistance, running outdoors, swimming, dancing, rowing, any of those types of activities. I think it's a good idea for someone to monitor their heart rate. And so someone who's exercising to 90% of their maximal predicted heart rate for a continuous period, 30 to 40 minutes, it's not that would not be a healthy situation. So when we talk about maximal predicted heart rate, we talk about the age subtracted by the number 220 multiplied by the target heart rate. So in general, someone should be exercising between 70, 75, and 85% of their maximal heart rate with bursts into the 85% range. So I don't know if you're familiar with Orange Theory Fitness.
I am.
So their exercise program is such that you're doing your basal rate of activity on a treadmill for a half an hour, and then for about 30 to 60 seconds, you go into your push mode in order for you to have your heart rate pass that 85% threshold. And then occasionally they'll throw in an all-out mode into the exercise program where you're exercising at about 90% of your maximal predicted heart rate. But they don't sustain that for a long period of time. They do that for about 20 to 30 seconds.
Then you break and go back to your basal.
Then you go back to your basal rate. And that regimen of exercise is called HIIT, or high intensity interval training. And that's a very useful way of exercising. There are other sports care facilities out there that incorporate different programs.
Right.
So I'm not necessarily promoting one program over another. Are you familiar with any?
Yeah. So I do something called Sweat 440. They have a lot of locations here. They just actually opened one in South Miami. Not promoting them, but I do like them.
Okay.
And basically it's 40 minute exercises. You can start, their motto is like, you're never too late to start exercising because they start classes every 10 minutes. And basically you go in, you do 40 minutes, there's four different stages with different workouts, and it's all like HIIT exercises. And it's very good, it's 40 minutes, you can't even tell that the time passes by. But yes, I find that it's very effective, I burn a lot of calories, and I feel great afterwards.
That's
great. So I like HIIT exercises for sure. And Can we get into the breathing techniques that we kind of spoke about off mic? I'm really interested to see what how that has changed for you.
It all started with my wife taking some tennis lessons in town. And the tennis instructor, I suggested to my wife that he knew a breathing specialist who was useful in terms of stress reduction. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about stress in the other podcast how high levels of stress could have adverse effects or do have adverse effects on long-term cardiovascular risk. Mm-hmm. So my wife thinks that I'm often too stressed out. So she suggested I consult with this breathing specialist. His name is Avi Greenberg. He's in the Miami Beach area. And he's actually studied this and taken courses on using breathing to reduce stress and just provide an overall healthier, serene lifestyle. And I know for a fact that he just went to Mexico for a week, and he took a course there in terms of floating on the surface of the water, followed by occasional immersion into the water. I know that he's taking courses on cold plunge. Cold plunge, for anyone out there who doesn't know what that is, it's going into a pool that's about 40 to 45 degrees temperature. And a buddy of mine went to Mexico some 20 years ago, and I was dared to go into this pool that was 40 degrees in temperature. And, you know, I had to take him up on it. So I submerged myself, and it was a real eye-opening experience. I also had a similar experience going to the beach in Maine in June, because I was living in New England for about 12 years. That's where I was prior to moving down to Florida 3 months ago. The water temperature on York Beach in Maine is probably about 50 degrees in June. So I can only go into my ankles.
Oh, God.
but the theory behind cold plunge is, you know, the shock sort of effect on the body. But what my breathing specialist explained to me is that, yes, there is an adrenaline surge that a person experiences going into the cold plunge. But following that, there's a relaxation phase. And then he incorporates immersion in the cold plunge accompanied by different breathing techniques to really maximize on the overall stress reducing effect, to affect a stress reduction.
I thought cold plunging was all about muscle recovery, but there's actually more to it.
There is more to it, yes. Okay. From what I'm hearing, this is all new to me.
Okay, me as well. So yeah. What did he have you do for those breathing techniques?
Right, so the breathing techniques are interesting. What we do is there are different ways of breathing, you know, generally not shallow breathing, but deeper breathing. So there's repetitive breathing, you know, five times in a row. There's breath holding for a certain duration of time, both at end inhalation and also at end exhalation. And I have to tell you, I've done about five of these breathing techniques. And during the experience, there is a stress reducing, or there's a calming effect on me. And then following that, I feel more relaxed and I'm able to focus better. And the most worthwhile aspect of the breathing technique is that when I feel stressed, be it at work or at home, you know, with something going on, I will incorporate the breathing technique and it will have a calming effect on me.
Okay. And so you believe that it's effective and it gives you a very good calming effect, right?
I do. If anyone's taken a sedative medication, you know, pre-procedure, the breathing technique has the same effect as a sedative medication. It's amazing.
Wow.
It's literally like taking a natural sedative.
That's crazy. I can't even believe that. I'm going to have to look into it.
Absolutely. I'll share his contact with you.
Yes, please. Can you provide some guidance on going back into now preventative heart care again? What is a goal blood pressure that everyone should keep in mind? And I know there's a common misconception among people where they're like, oh, I would know if my blood pressure was high. I would feel it. Mm-hmm. So can you go into a little bit more about that?
So we all know that high blood pressure, or hypertension, as it's called, is the silent killer because people don't have symptoms from it. It's only when the blood pressure is really high that someone has a really severe headache or feels dizziness, unwell, imbalanced, and then they come into the office and their blood pressure is 200 over 110, which is very, very high. The best way to monitor blood pressure is to see a doctor regularly. So if you're over the age of 18, maybe an annual or every 2 year follow-up visit, if you have medical problems already. You're obviously going to see a healthcare provider for those issues, and you'll have your blood pressure checked at those visits. Many women get their primary care at their OBGYN, so I implore the obstetrics and the gynecologist to take the patient's blood pressure at every visit, because that's a good screening mechanism. Also, there are health fairs every so often where blood pressure is being checked. If there's a family history of high blood pressure, I think it's a good idea for patients to buy a arm cuff. I don't really like the wrist cuffs. I don't think they're as accurate as the arm cuffs. And check your blood pressure a few times a week. Keep a log. And if your blood pressure is not at goal, and I'll mention those numbers shortly, then see a healthcare provider to have the blood pressure addressed. If you have high blood pressure, you're going to want to change your diet to reduce your salt intake and eat foods that are more heart healthy.
Okay, how much salt would you say? That's always a question with my patients.
Yeah, I think the older we get, the older our kidneys get. And the ability of the kidneys to handle salt is going to be reduced as we get older. So I think it's a good idea as we age to kind of try to reduce salt intake. The hard stop in terms of someone who has high blood pressure or significant heart disease, like heart failure, the recommendation is less than 2 grams or 2,000 milligrams per day of salt consumption.
Okay. How can we look out for that? We just have to be looking at the nutritional label, unfortunately.
You have to look at the label. And the other rule of thumb is if you go to a restaurant, you have to imagine that they're putting salt into the food, because that's what generally makes the food taste good.
Right.
Aside from the spices. But the food in the restaurants, certainly fast food more than non-fast food, there's going to be higher salt content.
Okay.
And that needs to be. I know a lot of the fast food chains have reduced the amount of salt. I know that an order of McDonald's fries today has less salt than it did 10 years ago.
Good. Thank you, McDonald's.
Just because I've eaten McDonald's fries. Yes.
And you were going to get into the numbers for blood pressure. What's the golden number that we should be looking for?
So the golden number used to be under 140/90, but I think we're at a point where the goal is less than
stricter control.
Yeah. Exactly. Less than 130 over less than 80.
Okay.
Obviously, if you're the guidelines say that between 130 and 139 over 80 to 89 is called prehypertension. So if you have prehypertension, you have other cardiovascular risk factors like history of diabetes, strong family history of heart disease, you're a smoker, you have elevated cholesterol, then you're going to want to tighten up your blood pressure control. Another important point I want to make is there's a new field that's been developing over the last several years called cardio-oncology. And what cardio-oncology does is it's a focus within cardiology to take care of patients with cancer diagnoses,
right?
Either active or a past history of cancer diagnosis. And the reason that's important is because there are certain medications that are being used to fight cancer that have adverse effects on the heart and the cardiovascular system. And it's good for a person on those medications to be plugged in with a cardiologist to make sure they're not having those adverse effects. Additionally, patients who have a diagnosis of a malignancy are at an increased risk of cardiovascular events later in life. So the two individuals that run the ACC cardio-oncology course annually always stress the importance of tight blood pressure control, tight cholesterol control, regular exercise, and healthy diet if you've ever had a cancer diagnosis.
Okay, and let's get into cholesterol, because I know that that's a daunting topic for a lot of people. What is generally recommended as a good cholesterol level to have?
Right, so if you're an individual that has no cardiovascular risk factors, including an absence of a family history of heart disease, I think a good rule of thumb is to have a total cholesterol less than 200 and an LDL cholesterol less than 160. Some practitioners would say 130 would be the goal. I would say the lower the better.
Right.
And if you can get below 100 for the LDL cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, that would be a good thing. I'm not going to take a 30-year-old individual and put them on statin medication to get their cholesterol below 100, but I am going to advise them that if they don't eat a healthy diet, that their goal should be to try to get their cholesterol below 100 if it's not already there. The person I'm going to put on statin medication is that individual that has multiple CAD risk factors, such as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, strong family history, diabetes, and someone who smokes. Someone who has had a cardiac event, so they've either been diagnosed with a heart attack, they had an abnormal stress test, required a stent to be deployed in their coronary arteries, or bypass surgery. These are folks that need aggressive cholesterol lowering, and they should have an LDL below 70.
Okay. And what exactly does cholesterol do to our arteries that cause harm?
Right. Very good question. So if you have elevated cholesterol, in other words, if your cholesterol is not where you should be based on the guidelines from the American Heart Association, American Heart College of Cardiology, then you're going to contribute to plaque formation in your blood vessels.
Okay.
That's the short end of it.
Yeah. Right.
So there's plaque buildup, which is, imagine a pipe that should be clean and the blood should be flowing through it regularly. Plaque is an obstruction to flow because of the movement of cells and fat particles into the area. So by not reducing cholesterol, by not eating a good diet, by not taking statin medication, you're contributing to that plaque buildup, which could eventually result in a heart attack or a stroke for that matter.
Okay. So Dr. Greenblatt, in your own words, what is preventative heart care to you?
Preventative heart care is looking at the total patient as an individual and determining what their risk is for future cardiovascular events. And by that, I mean an individual who's in their 30s with no medical problems and no family history, they're going to have a very low cardiovascular event risk. But someone who's in their 40s, who has three family members who had a heart attack when they were in their 50s, has elevated cholesterol, has borderline blood pressure, and borderline diabetes, this is someone that would want to see a preventative cardiovascular specialist.
And what do you do as a preventative cardiovascular specialist?
Good question. So what we do is, like I said, we take a look at the total patient and we look at, obviously we can't change family history because that's mm-hmm. genetics. Mm-hmm. We can identify genetics if someone's interested. There are different genetic testing centers. Berkeley Heart Lab is one. Invitae is another. But what we do is we basically assess overall risk and we outline a plan for lifestyle modification, including a regular exercise program, a healthy diet, avoiding foods that could be potentially harmful, and promoting foods that have been proven to be helpful in promoting cardiovascular health from a young age, so that during the future years, the person's risk is lowered. So we're basically trying to catch, you know, before the cat gets out of the bag, we're trying to keep it in the bag.
Right, of course. And then for those of us that are looking for cardiologists, there are many different types. So can you kind of tell our listeners, where can they start with?
Yeah, excellent question. The group that I work for, my cardiologist, on their website, illustrate the different providers and what their specific cardiovascular expertise is. And there are some providers, be it physicians or nurse practitioners, that focus on preventative cardiology. Some of them focus on prevention with an emphasis on women's health. Those are the providers that one should seek in determining who their preventative cardiologist should be.
Okay, so would you recommend just having seen a general cardiologist and then from there, the cardiologist will go ahead and decide if they need more specialized care?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I mean, we want everyone to have a primary care physician in the community. And then if there are cardiovascular concerns, either the patient themselves could refer themselves or be referred by their primary physician to a specialist. Most cardiovascular specialists are non-invasive specialists. Mm-hmm. And then a smaller group are specialized in terms of taking care of structural issues, stents, valve procedures that are non-surgical, electrophysiology. So that's a specialty of pacemakers and mm-hmm. defibrillators. So I would say that most cardiovascular specialists that advertise themselves as non-invasive will be good at cardiovascular risk prevention. And if there's a point, you know, that a physician and the patient come to where further expertise is required, then that general cardiologist or non-invasive cardiologist could make the referral to a more specialized cardiologist. There were a few patients that I attempted to control cholesterol, despite statin therapy or one of the newer agents, the injectable PCSK9 inhibitor drugs were just not tolerated, mm-hmm. then I would refer those patients to a lipid specialist or cholesterol specialist for further management. And they would in turn refer the patient to a nutritionist, you know, for a complete overhaul of diet and then an exercise regimen, because diet and exercise could help you lower cholesterol if you don't tolerate medications.
For those of us that have primary care providers already, when is a good time to see a cardiologist, in your opinion?
So I think everyone over the age of 60 should see a cardiologist just to determine their overall cardiovascular risk, because as we age, our risk for developing heart disease increases. Certainly patients who have a strong family history of heart disease should see a cardiologist earlier. I might argue to see a cardiologist in their 40s.
Okay.
Nowadays, we're doing colonoscopies on 45-year-olds. It used to be 50-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And that's across the board. That's not even people that have a risk of colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. So if we're doing colonoscopies on 45-year-olds, I think it's reasonable someone who has a strong family history of heart disease or known cardiovascular risk factors such as, you know, smoking, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, they should be seen by a cardiologist in their 40s. When I talk about my recommendation for patients to see a cardiologist in general, I'm not talking about patients who have symptoms that are concerning for heart disease. So if you're 27 years old and you don't have any risk factors for coronary disease, but you have palpitations or you have recurrent near fainting episodes, you should see a cardiologist to see what's going on. If you have palpitations, in all likelihood, the specialist will put a monitor on you to see what kind of rhythm is going on when you feel the symptoms. Very often, palpitations are simply an elevated heart rate, but some people have very fast heart rates with a heart rate of 170, 180 because of a condition called SVT or supraventricular tachycardia. Some people who have near fainting episodes frequently have an intolerance of standing quickly from a seated position or getting out of bed quickly. Those patients might have something called neurocardiogenic syncope or excessive vagal tone. The vagus nerve is one of the cranial nerves, and some people just have a hyperactive vagus nerve that results in a sudden drop in blood pressure and heart rate and could have effects such as severe dizziness, lightheadedness, and fainting. So people that are symptomatic that have concerns about having heart issues should see a cardiologist.
Okay.
Getting back to the question about calcium scoring that you had asked before, very often it's the patient that comes into the office and asks for the calcium score.
Yeah.
I had a patient in just yesterday whose LDL cholesterol was 150, which, and he has no risk factors nor family history of heart disease, but his primary care physician said, you know, your cholesterol is 150, we should get a calcium score to see exactly what's going on. So the coronary calcium score, basically what I want to explain what the test is. A coronary calcium score is a CAT scan that a patient goes through. It's a very quick study. It's not like a half an hour in an MRI, which is very difficult for those of us who are claustrophobic. But it's a quick test that basically scans the heart and determines a score for each of the four major coronary arteries. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about four major coronary arteries, we talk about the left main, the left anterior descending, the left circumflex, and the right coronary artery. And when we talk about coronary disease, there could be a blockage in those or any of their branch arteries. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other discussion about stents and so forth. But this gentleman had a total coronary calcium score of 182, but the individual scores of his vessels, he had like a score of 60 on his right coronary artery, a score of 80 on his circumflex, and then he had...
And what does that score indicate?
Right, so that's a good question. So the way we grade calcium scores is below 10, is very low risk. 10 to 100 is low. 100 to 400 is intermediate, and greater than 400 is high risk. So if someone has an LDL cholesterol of 150 and their calcium score was total of 187 with the individual scores below 100, I told the gentleman that his overall score was low to moderate and his individual coronary scores were low. And I told him that I wouldn't put him on statin therapy for that. I've seen people with LDL cholesterol of 140 and a calcium score of 1300. Okay, so that's quite a high calcium score. Two people, same calcium score. One of them was cathed, underwent cardiac catheterization, had clean coronary arteries, so no obstruction to blood flow. Does the person have plaque within the walls of the blood vessel? Probably, but nothing impinging or impeding flow. The other patient with the calcium score of 1300 ended up with quintuple or five-vessel coronary bypass surgery. So the coronary calcium score is useful in those patients that have multiple risk factors who you're trying to convince to take lipid-lowering or cholesterol-lowering therapy, such as statins.
Right, you can drive management, help management.
Exactly. Or someone you want to drive home the importance of diet modification, lifestyle modification, and exercise.
Right.
Yeah, so I think it's a useful test. A lot of insurance companies don't cover the coronary calcium score, but I think out of pocket, it's somewhere $150 to $200. So if someone's interested and they, you know, they have good reason to get it, I think it's a worthwhile evaluation.
Okay, and you know, a lot of patients come in asking for also an echocardiogram, you know, ultrasound of the heart. They know about it. Their primaries do it sometimes. When do you recommend someone to have that test done?
Excellent question. So an echocardiogram I generally do on someone who is coming in with symptoms of shortness of breath on exertion. to determine whether or not there's a weakening of the heart muscle. I also will do an echocardiogram on someone in whom I've heard a heart murmur.
Right.
So if there's a heart murmur, that's an abnormal sound that's emitted from the heart because of abnormal flow through the valves. There are also other clicks and sounds that we hear when we listen to a person's heart that suggest anatomic abnormalities, and an echocardiogram would prove useful in that situation as well. The other utility of echocardiography is if we do a stress test on someone, we have them exercise on a treadmill, as you know, or a bicycle if they're unable to walk on a treadmill, and we use EKG monitoring to determine whether there are changes in the EKG. So what's an EKG? An EKG stands for electrocardiogram. The original word was German, so cardio is spelled K-A-R-D-O, but in the United States and other English-speaking countries, we say ECG because cardio is spelled C-A-R-D-I-O. Mm-hmm. Gave you the whole rundown on that. Anyway, a basic ECG stress test uses the ECG to determine whether or not there are flow abnormalities in the heart.
Right.
Using echo with the ECG treadmill portion adds sensitivity to the test. So we can actually see the walls of the heart moving after someone's exercised to their target heart rate. And we talked about that before, that the target heart rate is 85%.
Right. I've also had patients come in and ask me for a stress test. They want a stress test every year. What are your thoughts about that? And what are the recent guidelines regarding when to order stress tests?
Right. So it used to be that cardiologists would order a stress test every year because the insurance companies allowed them to do so. Now that's not the case. So you need to have a good reason to get, I think it's reasonable to get a stress test initially, especially people with high risk or high responsibility occupation. So airline pilots, firefighters, police force, police officers, if they have any suspicious symptoms, they should be stress tested. The gentleman I saw yesterday works for Florida Fish and Game, but he's also doing some work on the border between Texas and Mexico in terms of the immigration issues that are going on there. And he told me that when he's wearing all of his gear, that he had some windedness. And the guy is 59 years old, so I suggested to him to get a stress test. So that's someone who, without a doubt, should get a stress test. He's responsible for, you know, the lives of his colleagues, the lives of the people that, get into trouble crossing the border. He said he's on a riverboat and he's literally pulling people out of the water because they're unable to swim.
Wow.
So it's quite dramatic. In terms of stress testing an asymptomatic patient annually, I don't think there's a
benefit.
There's no benefit for that, and I don't think it would be something that would be indicated. The American College of Cardiology is the community that gives us our guidelines along with the AHA, the American Heart Association, and they basically outline what's an appropriate time to do a stress test and what's not. So I generally, and along with my colleagues, follow those guidelines.
And I'm glad you mentioned that patient that came to you because he was feeling, you know, winded or short of breath. Because I do have a lot of patients that come in, you know, in the elderly population that they always say, I have shortness of breath, but I feel like that's because I'm old. You know, I'm old, so I feel like we should all be short of breath. And I'm like, that's not the case.
Yeah, no, 100%. The difficulty with people that are older who are not physically fit is that we really can't gauge what their exercise ability is. So I will generally, if I see an older person that complains to me that they feel dyspneic or an increased awareness of breathing during exertion or exercise, then that's someone that I would stress test. And if they're not able to do the treadmill, then I will do what's called a nuclear imaging stress test, in which we use a chemical agent to simulate exercise, and we can scan the heart using an isotope or a radioactive agent to sort of light up the circulation. I take shortness of breath very seriously in older women who have such symptoms because coronary artery disease is often masked in women patients.
Right.
We used to have an expression in residency and fellowship that women don't always read the textbook when it comes to cardiovascular symptoms because they might get symptoms that are not typical chest pain with radiation to the left arm or left jaw. And we need to listen to our patients and make sure that we're not missing coronary disease.
Yeah. What are some examples of that? I know that women can come in, complaining of abdominal pain.
100%. Yeah. The most dramatic story that I can think of is when I had joined, I was in Manhattan for a number of years and I joined I was part of a three-person group. Two of my colleagues were interventional. And one of my friends, an orthopedic surgeon, called me and said that his mother-in-law wasn't feeling well. And this is her cell phone number. So I called her. She was shopping for clothes. She had sudden onset of sweating, nausea, and vomiting. And she was a smoker, and she was a diabetic. Mm-hmm. So I told her daughter, who was also a friend of mine, I said, you know, get your mother to the emergency room right now. And then I called my partner that this was going on because he knew the orthopedic surgeon as well. And we wanted to get this, you know, figured out and addressed immediately. So my partner met her in the emergency department. He took her urgently to the cardiac catheterization lab, where he performed a procedure, you know, to see where the arterial blockage is. And she had 4 vessels that were obstructed. So she was literally having a heart attack at the department store with those symptoms. She ended up with bypass surgery that night. And I'm happy to say that she's still alive today.
Good. And I'm happy we're talking about this, because that is something that a lot of people don't know. They think that a heart attack is textbook elephant sitting on the chest, can't breathe, that intense pain, but sometimes it can be manifested in different ways, like just like how you spoke about nausea, vomiting, sweating, abdominal pain with women and men too.
Yes. So if you're over 40 and you have symptoms that you think are related to a heart event, then seek emergency medical attention.
Absolutely.
And a lot of women may think I'm protected by estrogen, but that's not necessarily the case, because if you have other cardiovascular risk factors, you know, seek medical attention, because if we miss the diagnosis, then we can't help you. But if we make the diagnosis, then we can save your life.
So for those of us with a family history of heart disease, and we can go into what that essentially means exactly, but what can we do to mitigate that risk? And is that risk ever 100% gone, or will there always be a risk?
If there's a strong family history of heart disease, then the individual with that strong family history needs to lead a heart healthy life. So if the individual is smoking, they need to quit smoking immediately. If they're not exercising, they need to start exercising. And they need to live by the expression, I am what I eat. So you really need to focus on heart healthy foods, such as those foods that promote cardiovascular health, and avoid those foods that are detrimental to heart health. And the most important thing that I would say is, if you have symptoms, then listen to your body and don't blow it off. Because if there's a strong family history, there's a high likelihood that the symptoms reflect an early warning mechanism and it should be evaluated.
Okay, so even if you do all the right things like exercise, quit smoking, not consume a lot of alcohol, would you say that, or what would you say is the risk for those individuals, even if they do everything right?
Well, I think if they're doing everything right and they're following the recommendations of their physician, I think they still need to see their cardiologist or cardiovascular provider.
Right, for regular
checkups, yes.
Because we symptoms
do,
and
we'll do an annual EKG, we'll make an assessment, we'll check the blood pressure, we'll make sure that we have all the bases covered, and they know that we're connected with them, so that if they run into trouble, if they have concerning symptoms, like they start to feel a little breathlessness when they're at minute 5 on the treadmill or jogging on the beach, then they know that they can call us and we'll set them up for a stress test, an imaging test, or even a heart catheterization if necessary.
We've been talking about what we can do to prevent risk and all of this for preventative heart care, but what can we do to hold our patients accountable? Because a lot of the times we give patients our treatment plan, we let them know what we think we need them to do, we see them again in a month, and unfortunately, you know, nothing's been done or they haven't progressed. So what can you recommend to our listeners that they can do to stay on top of their health?
Yeah, I think close follow-up with office visits is very important, because in addition to diagnosing and prescribing, we also have a face-to-face encounter in which we can really emphasize the importance of their following our instructions. And we can conduct tests. So if someone is on blood pressure medication and they come to the office and their blood pressure is still elevated, you know, one of two things is happening. They're either not adhering to their low-salt diet, or they're not taking the medication regularly. And I'll call them out on it. I'll say, are you taking your medication? And then they'll admit, oh, sometimes I forget. You know, and then in terms of weight loss, you know, patients say, oh, you know, I modified my diet, but I can't lose the weight. I used to have a partner a few years ago who said, it's simple math. It's calories in, calories out. In other words, calories burned. So if you don't exercise and you're eating the same amount of food, you're not going to lose weight. If you eat more, you're not going to lose weight. So obviously, they're still consuming the calories, because if they were consuming less calories, they'd lose the weight. So I think the frequent follow-up visits, you know, I'll see my heart failure patients every 3 months. But my patients who are not compliant with the regimen that I prescribe to them, I will bring them back more frequently to have that conversation with them. Show them the numbers, show them the blood pressure.
Right.
And I have illustrations that I can draw or show them in books or on the web. You know, this is what's happening to your body. And if you want to be healthy and have a long life, this is what you need to do. And if you don't follow these instructions, then you're not going to live long.
And I think full transparency is really important because a lot of our patients will come in and they just will keep it to themselves, or they won't tell you exactly what happened. Or they'll be like, oh yeah, doc, I definitely have been eating well. And then you see no progression. So for our listeners, full transparency is important. We're not going to judge you. You need to tell us exactly what you've been doing so that we can actually cater our care to you and help you the best way that we can.
Yeah. And I use a questionnaire for first visits. And the reason I do that is because something that the patient might not bring up in the interaction, they might write it down in the questionnaire. So I have them fill out the questionnaire, and then I use the questionnaire as a guide to the interview during the history part of the examination.
Yeah, and I think also that holding yourself accountable is important, but also include your family members, have them hold you accountable, let them know the plan that you're starting to do, your treatment plan, and they can help you hold yourself accountable as well. So including family care, your partner, your kids, and with your goals is really important.
It's true. Those patients who come in with a significant other are often going to do better because their significant other is on top of them to follow the advice of the healthcare practitioner, you know, the cardiovascular specialist. And they are often ones who see symptoms or signs that they're concerned about that the patient might not have brought up on their own.
Right.
So it's really important that if you have a family member that you're concerned about, and the individual's not seeking medical attention, but you think they would benefit from a consultation and frequent follow-ups, then go ahead and make the appointment, and because you're doing the right thing.
There are apps out there that help you in terms of like keeping a caloric deficit. Like there are, you know, MyFitnessPal, they have, if you do intermittent fasting, they have apps that can help you like set a timer so that you don't eat until that app tells you you have to eat. So there are different apps catered for you, but I think that's all individualized, and it's definitely, you know, if the patient wants a specific diet, they want to try intermittent fasting because they've heard a lot of good things about it, then you can go ahead and see what apps are out there that can help you stick to that goal of intermittent fasting for this long or however. So, and then also always being in a caloric deficit is important to losing weight. So monitoring your calories, if that's something that you're open to, a lot, I know a lot of patients are not open to monitoring their calories day in and day out, but if that's something that can really help you keep on track, then I recommend it. I think it's definitely based on what the person wants to do. How much do they want it? You know, how much do they want to lose the weight? How much do they want to download the apps? Because you can tell your patient as well, like, download the apps, but then they're like, yeah, and then they don't download it. So you really have to drive in the importance of how important it is for preventative heart care in order for someone to actually want to do those things. So, you know, this is what this is all about. I want people to want to be healthy, you know? I mean, everybody wants to be healthy, but they don't really understand what it takes. And this is why we're doing this. Mm-hmm. So that patients can know that it's not just it's checking their blood pressure, it's seeing a doctor, it's getting their blood drawn, doing the exercise regimen, having that Mediterranean style diet, and all of the above that can really just center on complete heart care.
I use the Framingham Risk Calculator, which incorporates, you know, gender, top number of blood pressure or systolic blood pressure, total cholesterol, right, HDL, whether or not someone's a smoker, and whether or not they're on blood pressure medications. And essentially, if you're below 7%, your risk is low, and if you're above 10%, your risk is high. So I use that risk calculator
to drive management
and tell people, okay, you need to be on statin therapy, or you need to get a hold of your life and you know, just really change your diet and exercise more regularly because you're at this degree of risk. People use Apple Watches to monitor their heart rates when they exercise, which I think is a good thing. But people with high anxiety are going to be focused on that heart rate, and then they're going to drive cardiovascular consultations because they're coming in to discuss why their heart rate is elevated, you know.
Yeah, I'm actually very happy with what Apple is doing with their Apple Watches. I've had patients come in that are like, my Apple Watch is telling me that I have AFib. And I'm like, wow, you know, like that's amazing how accurate it can be. And then, you know, we order the monitor, see if we can catch AFib, and then we go ahead and manage it. But it's just amazing the technology these days that they can detect AFib now just by having something on your hand.
It's true.
Know?
It's true.
So,
yeah, I think patients should, yeah, now that we have technology that's available for people, they can check their blood pressure at home. They can check their heart rate at home. They can check their EKG at home. There's a device called Cardio Mobile. Yeah, they have, there's one that if you hold a finger from each hand and then you lean on your knee, it can actually give you a 6-lead EKG, which is remarkable.
Yeah, so, we recommend that. We recommend blood pressure management, taking your blood pressure at home as well to further guide care for us. So all of these new devices are amazing.
Yeah, the reason why the purchasable rhythm monitors are good is because we could put a device on someone for a month, and then that month they might not have their symptoms, right, and we won't catch the rhythm that we're hunting for. We also have these new implantable devices called ILRs, or implantable loop recorders, and someone can have this in for 3 years. It's literally inserted under the skin like a large splinter without the infection risk, of course, because, you know, we prep it and put it in a sterile environment, but it provides a great deal of information. And it really reduces stroke risk in people because we're hunting for atrial fibrillation essentially. And if we determine that a person has atrial fibrillation, we can put them on a blood thinner and reduce their risk to zero. So
right. So if any of this sounds very interesting to you, or you think you might benefit for any of these devices, just come see one of the physicians at my cardiologist.
Yeah, we have offices throughout the Miami, South Miami, Miami Beach, and now Aventura and Boca as well.
Yeah, Dr. Greenblatt, where are you specifically located?
So I'm at Miami Beach in the mid-beach section right by 41st Street. I also am at an office in Aventura across the street from Aventura Mall on Aventura Boulevard, otherwise known as 199th Street. Okay. It's right off the Biscayne Boulevard.
I'm one of the nurse practitioners. I work with a multitude of doctors. Whoever needs me, I'm always there to support. And I work at the South Miami office location. But you can click on the link below and see our wonderful website. And it gives you all the information of our locations and all the different physicians and mid-level practitioners that are available to you.
Thank you for tuning in. And make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already. To learn more about My Cardiologist, please visit us at mycardiologist.com.